I'm with Peter Willoughby, Senior Associate in the Employment Relations and Safety Team at McCullough Robertson, a Queensland-based full-service law firm with offices in Sydney and Newcastle. Thank you for joining me today, Peter.
That's my pleasure, Natalie.
Now, Synergy's you've had the privilege of working with the Employment Relations Team at McCullough Robertson, and I'm excited to be chatting with Peter today about workplace investigations, handling of misconduct complaints, unfair dismissals, and we're also going to be chatting about the current environment in the FWC, which is where Peter spends a lot of her time, and she has a lot of really, really interesting information to impart to us today. So thanks for being with us, Peter. I think I'll start with the FWC's 2014-2015 annual report, which had some really interesting statistics given that it was the first year that the stop bullying legislation was in force and was being dealt with in the FWC. Mm-hmm. Now, according to the annual report, there were 694 stop bullying applications, which was a massive increase from the previous year, where there were only 197 applications in relation to that, you know, that topic for the previous financial year. So obviously this has a lot to do with the new environment with regard to stop bullying orders. Does it show that this mechanism was sorely needed for employees?
I think actually the figures are surprisingly low. The Fair Work Commission, I know, was expecting far more of these applications than ultimately have been brought both this year and in the previous year. But we are obviously seeing an increase in those applications. I think that it's a product of a couple of things. And one is that the jurisdiction is starting to be a little bit more understood, both by employers and by employees. And I actually think that the real impact is that employers have become alive to the fact that there's now a new jurisdiction where bullying can be targeted and are taking steps to protect themselves by implementing policies and training their workforces in them. And that's actually starting to sort of heighten awareness amongst employees of their rights. It's certainly only my opinion, but that's the trend that I've been starting to see over the past 12 months. There's been a lot more focus on policies, training, and as a result, complaints are starting to flow through. And what I'm seeing is that those complaints might be going back a number of years, but employees haven't known what to do about them and are now bringing these complaints because they can see that their employer is starting to take bullying seriously and they feel comfortable to do so. Now, I'm talking about internally, obviously. What's happening in the Commission, I think, is that employees are also becoming more aware generally because of media reports. And as a result, those companies that aren't putting in place appropriate mechanisms to protect employees are going to be more likely to be subject to the stop bullying order. Generally speaking, it's not the employer that's the respondent, it's another member of staff, but the employer gets brought in as under the principles of vicarious liability or because the employee alleges that they haven't done what they could to protect them. So there have been mechanisms available for employees for a long time to protect themselves from bullying, but now there is this one jurisdiction that has the label bullying. Both employers and employees are starting to take it more seriously.
We're also seeing, though, that, you know, of those massive number of applications, 694, nearly 700 applications, only 60 needed to be finalised by a decision of the Commission. What does that statistic tell you about the FWC dispute resolution process and what's happening in that process?
It tells me a few things. The first is that I don't think the jurisdiction is particularly well understood. So when you dig quite deep into those statistics in the annual report, it becomes apparent that a lot of those claims are discontinued at the very first hurdle, which is when the Fair Work Commission looks at an application, they get in touch with the applicant to get clarification. And a lot of the time at that point, we're seeing discontinuance of claims. Now, that tells me that people are perhaps misunderstanding what the point of the stop bullying jurisdiction is, and they're bringing claims that don't actually meet the threshold requirements for it. Or alternatively, as you'd be aware, there's no compensation available under stop bullying orders. The Commission only has a power to make an order that bullying cease. That's the extent of their jurisdiction. And there are, of course, some other jurisdictions where compensation might be more readily available, such as within the discrimination jurisdiction or within the work cover. And, you know, it's related areas in other states which are have different names in Queensland. WorkCover is the primary jurisdiction. So if people are suffering bullying and they believe it's for a discriminatory reason, or if they're suffering bullying and they suffer some sort of psychological injury as a result of that bullying, there are other jurisdictions where they can actually gain compensation, as well as the sorts of orders that we're talking about. So I think that people are becoming aware of that at that first stage and might be pursuing an alternate path.
Mm. Okay.
Other thing that I think about it, and this might be slightly cynical of me, but there are certainly, I think there is a lot of pressure on conciliators within the Commission to try to resolve matters before it proceeding to hearing. And so quite a large number are dropped at that first stage, and quite a large number are settled at the dispute resolution stage before they go to a hearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm wondering, though, whether, you know, the fact that so many applications are making it into, you know, to the Commission compared with previous years, to me that seems to say that those people feel that their matter hasn't been adequately dealt with within the workplace. I mean, if it was being adequately dealt with by the employer and they were getting a resolution that they felt was reasonable, they wouldn't feel the need to take it any further. So we're probably still seeing a problem out there with employers failing to act appropriately when these sorts of complaints are made.
I think that's absolutely
the case. They have to show that they've actually attempted to resolve it in-house first before they can go and make an application to the Commission. Is that not correct? They have to show that they've made their employer aware and their employer hasn't done anything.
Oh, look, they actually don't have to demonstrate that their employer has been made aware, and that is on the basis that it's not always the employer that is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the jurisdiction works is that all that's required is that the employee is at work in a constitutionally covered business. That doesn't have to mean the business in which they're employed.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not necessarily the case that the employer would even be aware.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is one of the things that the Commission is checking for in that first stage, as to whether or not this matter is should appropriately be dealt with by the Commission or should be referred back for some internal complaint handling. And certainly the first thing that should happen is that you just raise that with your employer. If it is your employer that you're having trouble with, try to resolve it in that way first, because the Commission will be interested to see what an applicant has done to try to resolve it themselves. Equally, the employer has to take some responsibility once this complaint's been made to try to make sure that they are doing what's necessary. And there's been a lot of criticism in those cases that we have seen of employers who haven't acted appropriately when a complaint's been made. One case that springs to mind, which I wasn't involved in but was quite well published, was a matter where there was a real estate agent who complained about being targeted by an administrative assistant who was targeting her in a number of ways, but one of them was by not adequately promoting this particular agent's properties, which obviously had an impact on her ability to do her job. She reported that to her employer, but the employer had no policies in place and didn't take any steps to try to action it, because they considered that it was, you know, just a personality issue between these two individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And the employer was very heavily criticised for not having taken any steps to do that in that case.
Mm. Yeah, we see that a lot in our work where, you know, management might write it off as being, oh, you know, they're just having a personality clash. You know, they can resolve it. They're adults. They can resolve it amongst themselves. Nobody's made any formal complaints, so we don't need to do anything, you know. Is that what you see a lot too?
I do see a lot of that, and I would really challenge that thinking, because I think one of the issues that can come up is that a lot of the time the issues that are reported are of a very low level, but when they've been sustained over a long period of time, the evidence is that those low-level incidents can actually be far more detrimental to an employee's mental health than a single instance, because a single severe instance is more likely to be dealt with at the time, and they won't feel that they're overreacting and complaining about that, whereas when you've got just perhaps snide remarks, or an issue like the one that I was describing where your properties aren't being displayed in the window, and it feels sometimes, I think employees feel, that it can feel a little bit petty to complain about those sorts of things, and so they just tolerate it for a long time until they reach the end of their tether. And by the time that happens, you know, all of the incidents that have gone before are lost to the mists of memory, and it's just not possible to actually take an appropriate action dealing with all these issues that the respondent wouldn't be able to reply to because it's happened over too long a period. That puts an employer in a really vulnerable position because they've gotten a complainant over here who may have actually suffered a psychological injury, and they had a responsibility to keep that employee safe, and at the same time they've got a respondent to whom they owe a duty of procedural fairness, which puts it in a really difficult position for employers.
Absolutely. We see this time and again where matters have been allowed to fester sometimes for years, and there have been, you know, the employer has been made aware that of what's going on. But like you say, the matters have seemed to have been written off as being too trivial, not serious enough. Oh, well, they're not willing to make a formal complaint, so we'll just see how it goes, and it becomes bigger than Ben Hur eventually when that person's, as you say, seeing psychologists and you know, claiming work cover and taking stress leave. So it's it can become a real mess, can't it?
I have a matter exactly like that at the moment where one employee reported an instance but wasn't prepared to be named or put on a formal complaint, but as soon as it reached the grapevine that somebody had made a complaint, five other people came forward and said they've had the same issues, because this has been an issue that's just been buried for years, and although we had one employee who wasn't willing to put a hand up and say, yes, I made a complaint, which made it really difficult for the employer to act when those other five employees came forward and said, I've had issues too, it actually looks like a much more serious issue than you might originally think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is what happens when matters are allowed to remain, or when a bully is allowed to remain in a workplace without being dealt with for a long period of time, is that there really is a situation where they're just targeting one person. They are frequently targeting several people in the organisation, and it only takes one person to stand up for the rest of them to finally get the courage to do the same thing. From the employer's point of view, they've just opened a Pandora's box, and I think a lot of employers are afraid to go there because they know it could potentially open that Pandora's box. Absolutely. And they want that to stay shut.
Absolutely, but that's exactly the wrong approach, because that's how you do end up with very serious psychological injury claims. And I don't know how closely you've looked at the statistics, or how closely any of the listeners have looked at the statistics, but psychological injury claims are by far the most expensive. A physical injury claim in the work cover jurisdiction is far less likely to have significant impacts financially on the employer than a psychological injury claim.
Yeah, and they're very hard to manage as well, from an employer's position, sometimes not being sure whether that psychological injury is genuine, and from a fraud point of view, trying to investigate a psychological injury is near impossible. So, I mean, you can investigate physical injuries in the workplace if you believe that somebody is being untruthful about the extent of their injury, but with psychological injuries, it can be very difficult. So.
Yeah, look, it can be difficult, especially before a claim is brought, when you're trying to manage that claim ahead of time. But there are methods that you can use to try to establish whether there's any veracity to it. And, I mean, obviously the first step, it's rare that an employee comes to an employer and says, I'm suffering depression because of this, or I've got an anxiety disorder because of this. All they're going to say is, this is happening to me. And at that point, some action needs to be taken, some investigation needs to be conducted in order to determine whether there's any truth to it. And in my experience, it's quite easy to see the signs once you've done a few of these sorts of matters. The difficulty that employers have is that they might only see a handful of those sorts of complaints in their entire careers. Whereas when you actually seek some advice from somebody who's dealing with this every day, I think it's very easy for them to see the red flags that say, this really needs to be managed carefully now, because this individual is at serious risk of bringing such a claim.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's sort of, you know, I think that's great advice from I think anybody dealing with a situation like this is go and seek some legal advice, talk to somebody who's dealing with these sorts of claims every day, because they could really, I guess, shed some important light on what's really going on, and help you with a path forward. So yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
I'd love to share some war stories about that, but the only one I can think of right now is just a little bit too gruesome, probably.
Tell us more.
But it certainly is the case that, you know, when you're dealing with this day in, day out, and I'm sure you'd also recognise this is true, Natalie, is that you get to develop a real instinct for how badly things can go. And in that very first phone call, I can often say to an employer, this is going to end badly, and this is where you could end up, and just try to manage it as best you can to get the best possible outcome for an employer, with the experience telling you that that's the point you're going to end up at, whether it's a discrimination claim or a work cover claim, or ultimately you're leading towards dismissal, which certainly can be the case sometimes when people end up in a position where they're no longer able to perform their role because of the injury that they've suffered, whether it's work caused or not. Certainly that can mean dismissal of employees, and that can result in all sorts of claims resulting from the dismissal as well. And it can be quite easy to spot when you're dealing with it all the time, in a way that an employer doesn't necessarily have the experience to be able to see just how badly it could go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is why it's so important for employers to look very deeply into cases of underperformance, because particularly if that employee started off with a good record and they were a good performer, and over time their performance is dropping, you have to really look at that and try to get to the bottom of it. Even if it means going in directions you really don't want to go in, which might be investigating, you know, complaints that they may have made off the record. And I think this is a really important thing to mention too in this discussion, is when complaints are made and they're made off the record, I think that conversation needs to be had, doesn't it, with the employee, saying, look, whatever you tell me, I cannot guarantee you confidentiality here if you're making allegations regarding misconduct.
Absolutely. And that comes back to, I think, the first example that I mentioned earlier, where one employee has approached a member of senior executive staff and has said, I've got these issues with somebody who sits near me, but I don't want them to know that I'm the one who's raised it. I just want you to do something to protect me. I don't want you to investigate. I don't want to be named. And that member of staff, the first thing that they did was to contact me and say, how do I manage this? And the conversation that I have to have is, you really need to push back on that, because you've got an obligation to keep this individual safe, and this individual is showing red flags. Yes. And so if you don't push back on that, you can't offer the respondent procedural fairness in order to be able to actually get to the bottom of whether there's a real problem here.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you can't get to the bottom of whether there's a real problem here, then you're really not doing a service to either one of the employees that are involved.
No.
In that case, I think we were fortunate that as I mentioned, as soon as it got around the grapevine that somebody had put their hand up and said, I'm struggling with this person, other people came forward. And that then led the first person to feel comfortable to be named as well.
Yes.
But it's not always as fortunate as that. And there really needs to be a hard conversation with the employee where you say, actually, I have an obligation to take this further, and I can't guarantee that your name will be left out of it.
No.
It's a tough conversation, but it's really important for everybody's well-being.
Absolutely, absolutely, because the flip side of that is the repercussions could be a lot worse if they take the opposite, point of view and wait for a formal complaint to come in before doing anything.
Well, it puts you in a really difficult position as an employer, I think, because you have to take some action. And if you don't, you're actually allowing this issue to fester in your workplace, and the longer it's left, the worse it gets.
Absolutely. It can have far-reaching repercussions, can't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of productivity, staff turnover, a whole range of issues that can be costly for an employer.
For everybody that's involved as well, on a personal level.
Yeah. So Let's look at the flip side of this. The employer has investigated a situation, they found out that workplace bullying or a similar form of harassment, misconduct has occurred, and they make the decision that it's a fireable offence,
mm-hmm.
that they need to dismiss this person, there are no other options for them.
Mm-hmm.
Employers can get themselves into a lot of hot water at that point too, can't they, they don't follow the correct process.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about, you know, what can happen as far as that, you know, where unfair dismissal matters do reach the FWC? What's the sort of worst case scenario there?
Yeah, sure. And look, I think you used the key word there, Natalie, and that is process. The biggest issue that we see is that even if there is a valid reason for the termination of employment, if it hasn't been conducted in a way which is fair and consistent with the legislation, that dismissal will still be unfair. And the absolute worst case scenario, particularly in a bullying situation like this, is that that employee could be reinstated back into the workplace. And that undermines trust for the whole rest of the workplace. You've got maybe a workforce of 15 people and 6 of those people have made complaints against this individual and then they get reinstated. Not only are you likely to lose those 6 people that made those complaints, but it also says that the company can't do anything to protect me. And that's really terrible from a reputational point of view for an employer.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that's absolutely the worst case scenario, reinstatement and an award for lost compensation. And that can be quite significant because by the time these matters come to trial, it's often years after the termination's taken place.
Yep.
So you could be talking about reinstating somebody back into the workplace and you have to compensate them for the lost remuneration in the meantime. Now, although reinstatement is the primary remedy, we don't see it all that often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we end up in a situation where most people accept that the relationship has ended and they're really looking for some compensation to tide them over until they find other work.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, we also find that they're looking for the opportunity to substitute resignation for their dismissal, which makes it easier for them to find other work.
Yeah.
If we're only talking about compensation, then the cap is 6 months compensation,
right.
or the equivalent of 6 months wages. We are also starting to see awards really at the higher end of that spectrum, so that's a pretty significant issue as well.
Okay. All right, so what do you think employers can do? What steps can they take if they've decided that misconduct has occurred and that the person needs to be dismissed? What steps should they make sure they're taking to avoid that situation?
I think the first thing that you need to bear in mind is that the fact that an instance of bullying has occurred doesn't necessarily mean dismissal can follow. I acted in a matter quite recently where the employer in question was a not-for-profit with a fairly small number of paid staff. Most of them were volunteers. And there was a particular employee who had quite a volatile personality. It was well known that she was quite volatile, but nothing had been done about that for 18 months or so. She'd been an employee for about 18 months. And then there was an instance which the employer said was effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, where there was a really heated exchange between this individual and another employee, to the extent that the witnesses in the room, who were members of the executive of the employer, felt that this individual was about to assault the lady concerned, and obviously formed a view that that wasn't acceptable, sought some advice from an IR advisor, and ultimately decided to dismiss. Now, the issue here is that there had been no previous disciplinary history. And a big part of the problem is that when they sought advice from their advisor, they told them that this was a pattern of behaviour, that there was a history of this. And so the IR advisor said, oh, well, if you've got evidence of that, then it'll be safe to dismiss, which is sound advice. But there was no evidence of the previous history in that case. And so for that reason, she had a clean disciplinary history. She was an employee who was aged over 45, which is the threshold at which the Fair Work Commission considers it will be more difficult for future employment to be obtained. And she had been ultimately dismissed for conduct where the accounts of what occurred were quite different between witnesses. So we came in to interview witnesses in preparation for the trial, and we interviewed about eight people, and there were eight different versions of the events of that day.
Okay.
So the issue that we've got here is that a knee-jerk reaction occurred to dismiss this employee for conduct that definitely was unacceptable, but in circumstances where previous conduct of a similar, although not so severe kind, had been tolerated, and where we didn't have a clear picture of what actually had occurred. So really the appropriate steps that should have been taken during that time would be to actually undertake an investigation to ascertain what the true facts were. Was it as serious as had been described by one witness, or was it actually at the end of the spectrum, which was described by the alleged victim, who actually didn't consider it to be that serious? So I think really the biggest mistake people make is to say, this thing's happened, I'm going to sack this employee. It's really important to get to the bottom of the facts and to actually look at it in the light of the whole history of the employee as well, and to make sure that you can back up everything that you're alleging before you make that decision to terminate employment. Once you've made the decision that this is potentially a terminable offence, then you have to give the employee an opportunity to respond.
Yes.
And that didn't appropriately happen in this case either. There was an attempt to give her an opportunity to respond, but there weren't sufficient particulars put to her to enable her to properly respond to what was alleged against her. And the outcome of that, unsurprisingly, is that on the doorstep of the trial, we actually settled the matter because this was going to be an unfair dismissal, and she was likely to be reinstated back into the workplace.
Which would have been the worst possible
scenario. As I said, there were only a handful of paid employees, and every single one of them had told the executive they would walk if she came back.
Oh, yes, we hear that a lot too. Yeah, yeah. And so you're potentially losing some really good people.
Yeah, for the sake of somebody who's not so good.
And for the sake of not following process.
That's right. If these steps had been taken along the way, we probably could have gotten that dismissal. But unfortunately, before it came to us, decisions had been made that couldn't be taken back.
Yeah. I've heard of situations where it's got to, you know, where the employer has probably had sound grounds for dismissal, but they've fallen down in the way in which the dismissal was conducted. By saying that, I mean, they've had the dismissal letter already typed up at the show cause meeting, or they haven't given a show cause meeting. They've just instantly dismissed them without giving them an opportunity to respond via that process. Is that your experience?
That's absolutely my experience, and it's also the case that I get people coming to me and saying, you know, we want some advice, but we also want you to do the termination letter. And I have to say, well, hold on. Have you really made up your mind already? Because if you have, we're in some trouble already. Ultimately, if you end up in a position where somebody sues, the person who made that decision is going to have to get in the stand and put their hand on their heart and tell the truth about when they made that decision. And if the answer to that is, I made the decision before I asked them to show cause, then it's all lost already. There's no coming back from that.
No, so typing up that termination letter before you give them a chance to respond is probably a bad idea too.
It's certainly not ideal. There are occasions when I actually have gone ahead and prepared the termination letter ahead of that taking place, but it's certainly the case that the advice that we're giving is, I'm only giving you this so that you can use it if you make that decision.
Right.
If you've already made that decision, then, you know, we're already in some trouble here.
Yeah.
You need to really think very hard about reconsidering your position on that.
Absolutely. I think a lot of employers tend to forget that, you know, this is somebody's bread and butter. This is how they pay their mortgage. Absolutely. This is how they pay their bills. So, you know, I mean, a lot of employers are very compassionate, obviously, and
Absolutely.
We're probably talking about a small handful that just see the bottom line or just want to get rid of the problem. So we'll get rid of that person because that'll get rid of our problem. But they have to make sure that they have adequate grounds to do so.
To be honest, I'd caution against too much compassion as well, because I've certainly seen situations where employers have tried to bear with an employee over a difficult period of time and as a result haven't taken steps that they should have taken, and then we end up back in that position where something bad happens and we've never done anything about the prior conduct. Compassion is a wonderful thing, but it needs to be tempered with an understanding of, you know, how best to protect the business.
That's right. I mean, we see that time and time again where, you know, the bullying behaviour, for instance, or the underperformance has gone on for a couple of years, and any conversations that have been had informally without witnesses, no notes or, you know, no diary notations have been taken, there's been no, you know, written correspondence between the parties, so there is no disciplinary history. There's no history that anything happened at all apart from what the witnesses might say or what the complainant might say. And in that situation, the employer's in a position where they basically have to start from scratch.
That's right. And the worst possible scenario that we see is when an employer comes to us and says, I've reached my final straw, and I have to say to them, well, what did you do about all the other straws? Because really we're starting again now. You know, this right here, that if you'd done something about the five things that happened before, you'd be in a position to dismiss, but you haven't, so this is only final warning territory.
Yeah, and I think probably having good, robust policies in place and having managers well trained in those policies.
Absolutely.
So that they can identify areas of potential misconduct and deal with them appropriately, so that there is a record in case it becomes a problem further down the track.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think documentation is, I'm a lawyer, so of course I'm going to say this, I say it all the time, but documentation is absolutely the key. If you're having that informal corridor chat, then go back to your desk and make a file note about it before you move on, because, you know, that can serve as evidence that these matters have been raised. But ideally, you wouldn't be having an informal corridor chat. You'd be having a formal sit-down discussion, which could result in a counselling, so that you've got documentation along the way. And I think a lot of the time, people fall into a trap of saying, well, he or she is having a difficult time in their personal circumstances, and so we don't want to make too much of this. But you've got to sort of take a step back and say, objectively, is this conduct acceptable? And if the answer is no, then it doesn't matter whether it's been motivated because of difficult personal circumstances. It still needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I think if somebody cannot conduct themselves in the correct way at work, then perhaps, you know, they should be on leave, although there should be some sort of situation whereby they can get some assistance with that right away.
Oh, absolutely,
just letting it go on.
And it does need to be, I think, a whole strategy that the employer has in place. A lot of employers also now have employee assistance programs in place as well. And so if you've got an employee who is perhaps acting out at work, and you can see that a large part of that is because they've got some personal situations going on, then refer them to the employee assistance program. Offer them some time off to enable them to deal with those issues, but don't let poor conduct go unchecked.
Definitely. Absolutely. Well, look, that's fantastic, Peter. You've been amazing today, and you've given us some really awesome insights into, you know, just what happens on the other side of the fence once things get before the FWC, and some really great advice on how to avoid those sorts of matters ending up there. So thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it, and we'd like to get you back again at some point in the future if you'll let us.
It's my pleasure, Natalie, and maybe I can come up with some war stories for you next time.
Oh, that'd be great. Thanks, Peter. Thanks for joining us today, folks. I hope you found that informative and interesting. Once again, we would love to hear from you, so definitely drop us a line via our website, synergyworkplaceinvestigations.com.au. You can email us at admin@synergywi.com.au or find us on Facebook. Thanks again for tuning in, everyone. Until next time.